Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Peace Talk. Peace Talk is produced by the Juneau Chapter of Veterans for Peace and is part of K2's Monday evening series, Focus on Community. Tonight we have an unusual program, a little bit different, and, just hope you enjoy it. We are today recognizing the ninth anniversary of the United States invasion and occupation of the sovereign nation of Iraq. And although combat troops have theoretically been withdrawn, and there is currently no U.S. involvement, we think it's a good time to recall the way that that war was started, the things that were being said by the people who were in charge, and to see if perhaps there are some parallels, either directly or indirectly, with the current drumbeating for war that is going on over the question of Iranian nuclear weapons. So with that in mind, we put together a program consisting of a reading of the first section of What I Heard About Iraq, which, as you may recall, when we produced it 6 years ago, involved a lot of quotes from U.S. leadership and others as to the cause, the causus belli. Excuse me, my Latin escaped me for a moment, but the reasons for going to war. And of course, as history demonstrated, they were mostly lies. Today, there's a lot of parallel information going on with respect to Iran. There are politicians, both in the United States and in Israel, who believe that a war against Iran and sort of designed to, quote, take out their nuclear facilities would not only be in the public interest here in the States and in Israel, but also for the entire world. So the specter of that Iran war is with us and continues to grow. Helping out this evening are some good men and true from the Veterans for Peace troop here in Juneau. They include Mark Stofa, Don Birdseye, Russ Strantman, Garland Walker, and Rich Moniak. They will commence with first reading from What I Heard About Iraq. And when they conclude with that, we'll take a short break, and then we'll start talking about Iran. And then we have a big treat, a mystery guest. It isn't really that much of a mystery. It's David Noon from the University of Alaska Southeast. And David has agreed to come in around 7:30 and talk about what parallels, if any, exist between the drumbeats for war against Iraq 9 years ago and against Iran today. So without further discussion or debate or elucidation on my part, why don't we just go ahead and begin What I Heard About Iraq. Go ahead.
In 1992, a year after the first Gulf War, I heard Dick Cheney, then Secretary of Defense, say that the U.S. had been wise not to invade Baghdad and get
bogged down in the problems of trying to take over and govern Iraq.
I heard him say,
"The question in my mind is, how many additional American casualties is Saddam worth?" And the answer is, not very damn many.
In February 2001, I heard Colin Powell say that Saddam Hussein
has not developed any significant capability with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He is unable to project conventional power against his neighbors.
That same month, I heard a CIA report state,
"We do not have any direct evidence that Iraq has used the period since Desert Fox to reconstitute its weapons of mass destruction programs."
In July 2001, I heard Condoleezza Rice say,
"We are able to keep his arms from him. His military forces have not been rebuilt."
On September 11th, 2001, Six hours after the attacks, I heard that Donald Rumsfeld said that it might be an opportunity to
hit.
Iraq. I heard that he said,
go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not.
I heard that Condoleezza Rice asked,
how do you capitalize on these opportunities?
I heard that on September 17th, the president signed a document marked top secret that directed the Pentagon to begin planning for the invasion of Iraq, and that some months later, he secretly and illegally diverted $700 million approved by Congress for operations in Afghanistan into preparing for the new battlefront.
In February 2002, I heard that an unnamed
senior military commander
said,
we are moving intelligence and intelligence personnel and resources out of Afghanistan to get ready for a future war in Iraq.
I heard the president say that Iraq is
a threat of unique urgency,
and that there is
no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess the most lethal weapons ever devised.
I heard the vice president say,
simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
I heard the president tell Congress,
the danger to our country is grave.
The danger to our country is growing.
The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb.
And with fissile material.
Could build one within a year.
I heard him say,
the dangers we face will only worsen from month to month and from year to year. To ignore these threats is to encourage them. And when they have fully materialized, it may be too late to protect ourselves and our friends and our allies. By then, the Iraqi dictator would have the means to terrorize and dominate the region. Each passing day could be the one which the Iraqi regime gives anthrax or VX nerve gas or someday a nuclear weapon to a terrorist ally.
I heard the president say that Iraq has attempted to purchase uranium. Later, he specified as yellowcake uranium oxide from Niger in thousands of aluminum tubes.
Suitable for nuclear weapons production.
I heard the vice president say,
we know that he's been absolutely devoted to trying to acquire nuclear weapons, and we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
I heard the president say,
imagine those 19 hijackers with other weapons and other plans this time, armed by Saddam Hussein. It would take one vial, one canister, one crate slipped into this country to bring a day of horror like none we have ever known.
I heard Donald Rumsfeld say,
some have argued that the nuclear threat from Iraq is not imminent. I would not be so certain.
I heard the president say,
America must not ignore the threat gathering against us. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
I heard Condoleezza Rice say,
we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud.
I heard Colin Powell at the United Nations say,
they can produce enough dry biological agent in a single month to kill thousands upon thousands of people. Saddam Hussein has never accounted for the vast amounts of chemical weaponry. 550 artillery shells of mustard gas, 30,000 empty munitions, and enough precursors to increase his stockpile to as much as 500 tons of chemical agents. Our conservative estimate is that Iraq today has a stockpile of between 100 and 500 tons of chemical weapons agent. Even the low end of 100 tons of agent would enable Saddam Hussein to cause mass casualties across more than 100 square miles of territory, an area nearly five times the size of Manhattan.
I heard him say,
every moment I make today, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. But what we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
I heard the president say,
Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas.
I heard him say that Iraq
could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes after the order is given.
I heard Tony Blair say,
we are asked to accept Saddam decided to destroy these weapons. I say that such a claim is palpably absurd.
I heard the president say,
we've learned that Iraq has trained Al-Qaeda members in bomb-making and poisons and deadly gases. Alliance with terrorists could allow the Iraq regime to attack America without leaving any fingerprints.
I heard the vice president say,
"There's overwhelming evidence there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government. I'm very confident there was an established relationship there."
I heard
Colin Powell say,
"Iraqi officials deny accusations of ties with Al-Qaeda. These denials are simply not credible." I heard
Condoleezza Rice say,
"There clearly are contacts between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein that can be documented."
I heard the president say,
"You can't distinguish between Al-Qaeda and Saddam."
I heard
Donald Rumsfeld say,
"No terrorist state poses a greater or more imminent threat to the security of our people."
I heard Donald Rumsfeld say he would present no specific evidence of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction because it might jeopardize the military mission by revealing to Baghdad what the United States knows.
I heard the Pentagon spokesman call the military plan
Heyday.
Or
shock and awe.
300 or 400 cruise missiles launched every day until
There will not be a safe place in Baghdad.
Until
you have this simultaneous effect, rather like a nuclear weapon at Hiroshima, not taken days or weeks, but in minutes.
I heard the spokesman say,
"You're sitting in Baghdad, and all of a sudden, you're the general of 30 of your division headquarters have been wiped out. You also take the city down. By that, I mean you get rid of their power, water, and
two, three, four, five
days. They are physically, emotionally, and psychologically exhausted."
I heard him say,
"The sheer size of this has never been seen before, never contemplated."
I heard Major General Charles Swank promise that his troops were going to
use a sledgehammer to smash a walnut.
I heard the Pentagon spokesman say,
"This is not going to be your father's Persian Gulf War."
I heard that Saddam's strategy against the American invasion would be to blow up dams, bridges, and the oil fields, and to cut off food supplies to the south, so that the Americans would suddenly have to feed millions of desperate civilians. I heard that Baghdad would be encircled by two rings of the elite Republican Guard, in fighting positions already stocked with weapons and supplies, and equipped with the chemical protective gear against the poison gas or germ weapons they would be using against the American troops.
I heard Vice Admiral Lowell Jacoby tell Congress that Saddam would
employ a scorched earth strategy, destroying food, transportation, energy, and other infrastructures, attempting to create a humanitarian disaster.
And that he would blame it all on the Americans.
I heard that Saddam had elaborate and labyrinthine underground bunkers for his protection, and that it might be necessary to employ B-61 Mod 11 nuclear bunker buster bombs to destroy them.
I heard the vice president say that the war would be over in
weeks rather than months.
I heard Donald Rumsfeld say,
"It could last 6 days, 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months.
I heard him say there was
no question
that American troops would be
welcomed. Go back to Afghanistan. The people were in the streets playing music, cheering, flying kites, and doing all the things that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda would not let them do."
I heard the vice president say,
"The Middle East expert Professor Fouad Ajami predicts that after liberation, the streets in Basra and Baghdad are
sure to erupt in joy."
I heard the vice president say,
"I really do believe we will be greeted as liberators."
I heard Tariq Aziz, the Iraqi foreign minister, say,
"American soldiers will not be received by flowers. They will be received by bullets."
I heard that the president told the television evangelist Pat Robertson,
"Oh, we're not going to have any casualties."
I heard the president say that he had not consulted with his father about the coming war. He said,
"You know he is the wrong father to appeal to in terms of strength. There is a higher father I appeal to."
I heard the president tell the Iraqi people on the night before the invasion began,
"If we must begin a military campaign, it will be directed against the lawless men who rule your country and not against you. As our coalition takes away their power, we will deliver the food and medicine you need. We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near.
I heard him tell the Iraqi people,
"We will not relent until your country is free."
And that concludes the reading of excerpts from What I Heard About Iraq. Of course, we know the history. We're reminded once again of how the leadership of our country and others managed to get us entangled in a war that costs us well over 4,500 American troops' lives. We know that that war cost us something in the neighborhood of $2.5 trillion with ongoing expenses. We know that that war brought us a situation in which thousands, literally tens of thousands, of American soldiers have been maimed and harmed for life and will need support. And we know that at least 200,000 and up to an estimated 1.2 million Iraqi citizens were killed in the war, and that 5 million Iraqi citizens were displaced by the war. And we know that when all was said and done, after we withdrew our formidable forces from that beleaguered country, most of the infrastructure had been destroyed, and there is tremendous political instability. So although the president was willing to say, "We will not relent until your country is free," it didn't seem to work. It was another case where war is not the answer. As we go forward now, fast forward, we're still in Afghanistan trying to extract ourselves from that mess. And we are now turning enormous amounts of attention to the situation in Iraq. We continue now in the mode of What I Heard About Iraq by quoting from a variety of sources what people have been saying about the Iranian threat and what we might consider doing about it. I'm going to go ahead now and turn these guys loose again. They're doing a great job, considering that we never really spent a lot of time rehearsing this. Gave them a script when they walked in the door. So I'm very, very pleased with the way it's going. Hope you're enjoying it. And let's now go through the second half of our readings and talk about what we're hearing about Iran. Go ahead.
Scott Peterson at the Christian Science Monitor did a useful timeline for dire Israeli and U.S. predictions of an imminent Iranian nuclear weapon beginning 20 years ago.
1992, Israeli Member of Parliament Benjamin Netanyahu predicts that Iran was 3 to 5 years from having a nuclear weapon.
1992, Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres predicts an Iranian nuclear warhead by 1999 to French TV. 1995, the New York Times quotes U.S. and Israeli officials saying that Iran would have the bomb by 2000.
1998, Donald Rumsfeld tells Congress that Iran could have an intercontinental ballistic missile that could hit the U.S. by 2003.
March 6, 2012, William Kristol of the Weekly Standard. If President Obama continues to insist that it is Israel who takes the lead, the task of American Friends of Israel will be to ensure that President Obama at least lives up to his promises Sunday that, quote, "When the chips are down, I have Israel's back. The chips will soon be down. When Israel acts on behalf of the civilized world, the least the American president can do is have her back."
David Grossman, the leading Israeli novelist of the last generation and strongest voice of his country's moral conscience, told the magazine The Nation that he opposed an attack on the Islamic Republic of Israel or the U.S., saying the likely consequences were more daunting even than those of Iran building nuclear weapons. "If Israel bombs Iran," he said, "I think it will be seen as an arrogant, megalomaniacal, violent nation, even by the most sober, moderate Iranians. Thus, Israel's hope for peace, or even just quiet, with a future better Iranian government would be eradicated for generations, he maintained.
In an interview with Ronnie Bergman of Foreign Affairs in 2007, Netanyahu said, "We need to prepare for a situation in which we have failed and Iran has succeeded in acquiring a bomb. Against lunatics, deterrence must be absolute, total. The lunatics must understand that if they raise their hand against us, we will hit them in a way that will eviscerate any desire to harm us."
On January 24th of this year, in his State of the Union address, President Obama was pretty clear about U.S. intentions. "Let there be no doubt, America is determined to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and I will take no options off the table to achieve that goal."
A year earlier, the Christian Science Monitor wrote, "Breathless predictions that the Islamic Republic will soon be at the brink of nuclear capability, or worse, acquire an actual nuclear bomb, are not new."
For more than a quarter of a century, Western officials have claimed repeatedly that Iran is close to joining the nuclear club. Such a result is always declared unacceptable and a possible reason for military action, with all options on the table to prevent upsetting the Mideast strategy dominated by the U.S. and Israel. And yet, those predictions have time and time again come and gone. This chronicle of the past predictions lends historical perspective to today's rhetoric about Iran. Let's review the history.
Fear of an Iranian nuclear weapon predates Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, when the pro-West Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was deep in negotiations with the U.S., France, and West Germany on a nuclear energy spending spree that was to yield 20 reactors.
In the late 1970s, the U.S. receives intelligence that the Shah has set up a clandestine nuclear weapons development program. In 1979, the Shah, ousted in the Iranian Revolution, ushered in the Islamic Republic. After the overthrow of the Shah, the U.S. stopped supplying highly enriched uranium, HEU, to Iran. The revolutionary government, guided by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, condemned nuclear weapons and energy and for a time stopped all projects.
1984, soon after West German engineers visit the unfinished Bushehr nuclear reactor, Jane's Defense Weekly quotes West German intelligence sources saying that Iran's production of a bomb is entering its final stages. U.S. Senator Alan Cranston claims Iran is 7 years away from making a bomb. Though Israel had secretly done business with the Islamic Republic after the 1979 revolution, seeking to cultivate a Persian wedge against its local Arab enemies, the early 1990s saw a concerted effort by Tel Aviv to portray Iran as a new and existential threat.
In 1992, as noted, Israeli parliamentarian Benjamin Netanyahu tells his colleagues that Iran is 3 to 5 years from being able to produce a nuclear weapon, and that the threat had to be uprooted by an international front headed by the U.S. And Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres tells French television that Iran was set to have nuclear warheads by 1999. "Iran is the greatest threat and greatest problem in the Middle East," Peres warned, "because it seeks the nuclear option while holding a highly dangerous stance of extreme religious militancy." Although in 1992, Joseph Alfer, a former official of Israel's Mossad spy agency, says, "Iran has to be identified as enemy number one. Iran's nuclear program," he told the New York Times, "really gives Israel the jitters."
The same alarm bells were already ringing in Washington, where in early 1992, a task force of the House Republican Research Committee claimed that there was a 98% certainty that Iran already had all or virtually all of the components required for 2 or 3 operational nuclear weapons. Similar predictions received airtime, including one from then CIA Chief Robert Gates, that Iran's nuclear program could be a serious problem in 5 years or less. Still, the bureaucracy took some time to catch up with the Iran threat rhetoric. 1992, leaked copy of the Pentagon's defense strategy for the 1990s makes little reference to Iran, despite laying out seven scenarios for potential future conflict that stretch from Iraq to North Korea.
1995, the New York Times conveys the fears of senior U.S. and Israeli officials that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought. About 5 years away, and that Iran's nuclear bomb is at the top of the list of dangers in the coming decade. The report speaks of an acceleration of the Iranian nuclear program, claims that Iran began an intensive campaign to develop and acquire nuclear weapons in 1987, and says Iran was believed to have recruited scientists from the former Soviet Union and Pakistan to advise them. In 1997, the Christian Science Monitor reports that U.S. pressure on Iran's nuclear suppliers had forced Iran to adjust its suspected timetable for a bomb. Experts now say Iran is unlikely to acquire nuclear weapons for 8 or 10 years.
But Iran was putting the pieces of its strategic puzzle together. A U.S. spy satellite detected the launch of an Iranian medium-range missile, sparking speculation about the danger posed to Israel. 1998, the New York Times said that Israel was less safe as a result of the launch, even though Israel alone in the Middle East possessed both nuclear weapons and long-range missiles to drop them anywhere. The major reaction to this is going to be from Israel, and we have to worry what action the Israelis will take, the Times quoted a former intelligence official as saying. An unidentified expert said this test shows Iran is bent on acquiring nuclear weapons because no one builds an 800-mile missile to deliver conventional warheads. 1998, same week, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld reports to Congress that Iran could build an intercontinental ballistic missile, one that could hit the U.S. within 5 years. The CIA gave a time frame of 12 years.
2002, CIA warns that the danger from nuclear-tipped missiles, especially from Iran and North Korea, is higher than during the Cold War. Robert Walpole, then a top CIA officer for strategic and nuclear programs, tells a Senate panel that Iran's missile capability had grown more quickly than expected in the previous 2 years, putting it on par with North Korea. The threat will continue to grow as the capabilities of potential adversaries matures, he says. 2002, President George W. Bush labels Iran as part of the Axis of Evil, along with Iraq and North Korea.
In August 2002, the Iranian opposition group announces that Iran is building an underground uranium enrichment facility at Natanz, a heavy water reactor at Arak. It is widely believed that the evidence had been passed to the group by Israeli intelligence. Enrichment and reactors are not forbidden to Iran as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the failure to disclose the work prompts the IAEA investigation and much closer scrutiny. Iran insists its efforts are peaceful, but is found in breach of its IAEA safeguards agreement and accused by that group of a pattern of concealment.
In 2004, then-Secretary of State Colin Powell tells reporters that Iran have been working on technology to fit a nuclear warhead onto a missile. We are talking about information that says they not only have the missiles, but information that suggests they are working hard about how to put the two together. In the next year, 2005, the U.S. presents 1,000 pages of designs and other documentation allegedly retrieved from a computer laptop in Iran the previous year, which are said to detail high explosives testing and nuclear-capable missile warhead. The alleged studies, as they have been since called, are dismissed by Iran as forgeries by hostile intelligence services.
In 2006, the drums of war beat faster after the New Yorker's Seymour Hersh quotes U.S. sources saying that a strike on Iran is all but inevitable, and that there are plans to use tactical nuclear weapons against buried Iranian facilities. The next year, President Bush warns that a nuclear-armed Iran could lead to World War III. Vice President Dick Cheney had previously warned of serious consequences if Iran did not give up its nuclear program.
A month later, an unclassified National Intelligence Estimate, NIE, on Iran is released, which controversially judges with high confidence that Iran has given up its nuclear weapons effort in fall 2003. The report, meant to codify the received wisdom of America's 16 spy agencies, turns decades of Washington assumptions upside down. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad calls the report a victory for the Iranian nation. An Iranian newspaper editor in Tehran tells the Christian Science Monitor the conservatives feel the chance of war against them is gone.
In June of 2008, then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, predicts that Israel will attack Iran before January 2009, taking advantage of a window before the next U.S. president came to office. Almost a year later, in May 2009, U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee report states, there is no sign that Iran's leaders have ordered up a bomb.
Despite reports and intelligence assessments to the contrary, Israeli and many U.S. officials continue to assume that Iran is determined to have nuclear weapons as soon as possible. An August 2010 article by Jeffrey Goldberg in the Atlantic's September issue is published online, outlining a scenario in which Israel would choose to launch a unilateral strike against Iran with 100 aircraft because a nuclear Iran poses the gravest threat since Hitler to the physical survival of the Jewish people.
Drawing on interviews with roughly 40% 40 current and past Israeli decision makers about a military strike, and American and Arab officials, Mr. Goldberg predicts that Israel will launch a strike by July 2011. The story notes previous Israeli strikes on nuclear facilities in Iraq and Syria, and quotes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying, "You don't want a messianic apocalyptic cult controlling atomic bombs. When the wide-eyed believer gets hold of the reins of power and the weapons of mass death, then the world should start worrying, and that's what is happening in Iran."
In 2010, U.S. officials note that Iran's nuclear program has been slowed by four sets of U.N. Security Council sanctions and a host of U.S. and EU measures. The Stuxnet computer virus also played havoc through 2011 with Iran's thousands of spinning centrifuges that enrich uranium. In January 2011, when Meir Dagan steps down as director of Israel's Mossad spy agency, he says that Iran would not be able to produce a nuclear weapon until 2015. Israel should not hasten to attack Iran, doing so only when the sword is upon its neck, Mr. Dagan warned. Later he said that attacking Iran would be a stupid idea. The regional challenge that Israel would face would be impossible.
That same month, a report by the Federation of American Sciences on Iran's uranium enrichment says there is no question that Tehran already has the technical capability to produce a crude nuclear device. February 2011. National Intelligence Director James Clapper affirms in testimony before Congress that Iran is keeping the option open to develop nuclear weapons in part by developing various nuclear capabilities and better position itself to produce such weapons should it choose to do so. Mr. Clapper said, "We do not know however, if Iran will eventually decide to build nuclear weapons. In November 2011, the IAEA claims for the first time that Iran has worked on weapons-related activities for years, publishing detailed information based on more than 1,000 pages of design information that is corroborated, it says, by data from 10 member states and its own investigation and interviews.
As the U.S. presidential campaign lurches forward to a vote in November, it is instructive to heed the candidates' stated positions on Iran. The GOP presidential candidates have been steadily trying to outdo one another on who is more bellicose on Iran.
Early this month, Mitt Romney declared in a Washington Post op-ed that President Barack Obama was the, quote, most feckless president, close quote, since Jimmy Carter, and charged that while Obama frets in the White House, the Iranians are making rapid progress toward obtaining the most destructive weapons in the history of the world. Speaking about Iran from a post-caucus rally in Springfield, Missouri, on March 11th, Rick Santorum stated, "The President of the United States may not believe we're in a holy war, as Iran's leaders do. They're out there specifically targeting Israel and the Jewish people. We've seen this before. We don't want to see it again. We need a president who's willing to stand up and make sure that never happens again." Obama has said he has Israel's back, Santorum added. I said, "No, you've turned your back on Israel." And if you listen to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech, it was a speech from a man pleading from a country that is being targeted for annihilation by a bunch of radical Islamists.
Newt Gingrich says, "I would also point out that a Gingrich presidency would communicate publicly to the Iranians that if they continue to do what they are doing, they should expect to get hit, and it will be their fault for having caused it."
And those are the words that we're hearing about Iraq. It's been a tangled history. It goes back quite a ways. And for some reason, everybody is absolutely terrified that Iran might, in fact, gain access to a nuclear weapon and, in fact, use it. Well, I want to thank the folks who did these readings for us, Rich Moniak and Garland Walker and Russ Strantman and Don Birdseye and Mark Stofa. It's been a good crew, and I really appreciate your efforts. And I'm also now at this point pleased to be able to turn to David Noon, our special guest this evening from the University of Alaska Southeast. I'm wondering, David, did you hear anything that sounded familiar?
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly I think one of the opening pieces that somebody read there was about the this kind of endlessly scrolling timeline that's been in effect. You know, predictions about imminent Iranian nuclear capability going back to the early 90s, and so we've been hearing this kind of periodical recitation of the same script. You know, Iran is on the verge of a weapon, but we've also heard the same script about an imminent attack, whether it's an attack from Israel on its own or an attack some way coordinated with the United States. So there is this kind of Groundhog's Day quality to it.
That's a good way of putting it. Well, as you can imagine, Veterans for Peace are very, very concerned that this country of ours just might take up arms, either directly against Iran or indirectly in support of Israel. And the things that seem to be in place to make that happen are things that have or should have nothing to do with our foreign policy, including domestic politics, end times predictions from some religious areas, and a concern that Israel is, at this point, about as nutty as you can get. Mr. Netanyahu is certainly a right-winger and has been, as we noted in here, saying for the last 20 years that Iran is close to having a nuclear weapon, and so we have to go bang on him.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd be cautious there. The nutty element in Israel at the moment just is, for the most part, the ruling coalition, which is extraordinarily conservative. On the other hand, you look at opinion polling among Israelis, and you see quite a bit more sensitivity and sensibility displayed about the possibility of an attack on Iran. Israelis understand more directly than Americans do what the consequences of that would be. And so it's interesting, if you look at the polling, a vastly larger percentage of Americans are kind of casually supportive of an attack on Iran than among Israelis. And the Israeli press is quite dramatic, baseline position among the mainstream Israeli press is one of panic. But again, I think you look at the Israeli public opinion as a whole, they're concerned about the possibility of Iran getting a weapon, but they're not vastly supportive of doing something dramatic and kind of poorly conceived.
Yeah, well, one of the other things I sort of think might contribute to the bellicosity in the United States is it's an election year. And, people, as we noted here, are sort of falling all over themselves, trying to be the most hawkish in order to gain support from the Republican base, and not just the Republican base, but a lot of people around the country. The president has been very, very careful not to rule out some type of American involvement in a war with Iran, and it just looks to me like many of the elements are coming together, and that we need to be very concerned and very careful as we approach this. Rich, did you have a question? Rich Moniak?
Yeah, I just wanted to add on something that David said about the Israeli public. There was a piece in the New York Times back in January of this year written by Shibli Talami and Stephen Kull, and one of them is a professor of government at Maryland, and the other is a director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes. And they had a poll put together with help from an Israeli organization that says 64% of the people in Israel favor a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, even if that means giving up its nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that would I think make a good deal of sense. Certainly, Iran's motivation, if it exists, to get a weapon is conditioned by all the sorts of factors that would drive anyone, any state to acquire that kind of weapon. It's something that already exists in the region. It's potentially useful as a deterrent, but for not much else. I mean, nuclear weapons don't have any real kind of operational value. And certainly for Iran, as erratic as its governing kind of as the revolutionary leadership, I think, pretty well understands, in spite of their erratic behavior from time to time, they're not driven to national suicide. So I think that is something to keep in mind. I guess on the question of Phil, you were sort of speculating on kind of things coming together. I don't know if this makes me unwisely optimistic about it, but I think it's certainly one thing that seems clear, even though the Obama administration they're not ruling anything out. They're also not doing any of the things that we saw the Bush administration doing from the summer of 2002 onward, which is aggressively promoting and creating this kind of feedback loop with the press, with, say, the New York Times, developing bogus intelligence, feeding it to established kind of respectable representatives in the press, and then using that press coverage to kind of justify kind of further ramping up of the justifications for war. So we don't see the Obama administration doing any of that kind of public relations work. And in spite of the statements, you know, we're not going to rule anything out. He's said recently to AIPAC that we have a policy not of containment but of prevention. You know, so there is a kind of – I think there's a posture there, but it's also kind of notably missing all of the other elements that sort of drove us off the cliff, you know, in 2003. So – So right now, I mean, obviously anything is possible, but I'm inclined to think that there's nothing, at least that this administration is going to do. It's incredibly risky in this election year, for opponents to be running on that kind of bellicosity. You know, presidential candidates are, you know, usually going to, you know, strike some kind of more aggressive posture and try to portray the, you know, sitting administration as being weak on something, but I think it's a pretty risky step to kind of run a campaign that more or less promises some kind of attack, and certainly we're seeing that from most visibly from Rick Santorum, but in somewhat muted fashion from Romney himself. I'm not sure that's a real comfortable position for them to be in.
Yeah, I guess one of my concerns is that there's a whole semi-nation of the neocons is waiting in the wings and, you know, just hoping that as soon as they get one of theirs elected that they'll, you know, reinstall Bolton into the United Nations and, you know, that the stars and stripes and so forth will be in alignment and we can get back to the good old days when George Bush invaded Iraq. But I hope I'm wrong, and I hope you're right, and I'm not quite as optimistic as you are, but I appreciate optimism at all costs. We are planning to develop a small campaign here in Juneau to perhaps get our elected officials involved to suggest to our state or our national delegation that they should not just go leaping into this blindly. And the other thing that sort of, and maybe you can help me on this, the other thing that really drives me nuts, and more so than in Iran than in Iraq, is the degree to which the intelligence is just all over the landscape. I mean, in 2007, 16 intelligence agencies in the United States says, you know, they abandoned any plans for nukes back in 2003. And a lot of people breathed a deep sigh of relief. Mr. Netanyahu didn't, and others. And now we're once again assured that for years they've been working on this. I mean, how do we have the foggiest idea of what to believe?
Well, the one key difference between Iraq and Iran is that whereas weapons inspections in Iraq had basically been suspended for 3 years, or 4 years almost, from 98 through late 2002, you know, the IAEA has been in Iran all the time. It's a pretty heavily inspected nuclear landscape there, so to speak. And, you know, so certainly, you know, if we sort of measure all the opinions out there and include the most kind of, I suppose, catastrophic interpretations of Iranian intentions, then yeah, it looks, you know, all over the map, like you say. But in terms of you know, hard evidence, there's really nothing there to suggest that Iran is anywhere close to, you know, developing a weapon, and certainly nowhere close to the point that its, you know, harshest critics would, you know, have us believe. So I think that is a key difference. It's certainly, you know, always hard to suss out the you know, the state of mind of you know, foreign leaders, particularly in a you know, when you're talking about a country that's as isolated as Iran is right now. But I think, you know, one thing that Americans tend not to understand is that the public face of Iran, which is Ahmadinejad, he doesn't have really any control over the country's national security policy, and that's all under the control of the clerics. You know, so for, you know, whatever, you know, poorly conceived or, you know, mistranslated in some cases statements that Ahmadinejad has made, ultimately he has, you know, really no significant role on Iran's nuclear program. Where I think that there's room for some kind of, I suppose, diplomacy, or at least I'm not sure how quite you describe this, but I guess some pressure is that the Iranian clerics have stated quite openly that nuclear weapons are contrary to Islam. They might be lying, but it's certainly it's a statement that you can hold leaders to. And Stephen Walt, his international relations prof at Harvard, he's pointed this out before. He says, we've got certainly plenty of Christians and scholars who have made the point that nuclear weapons are, theologically unsustainable. You've never had an American president who's, used religious language to condemn nuclear weapons. In fact, when Harry Truman announced the use of the atomic bomb for the first time, he thanked God for giving that technology to the United States. So I think that there's room to use that kind of religious rhetoric, to kind of put pressure, at least, public opinion pressure on the folks in Iran who actually have the decision-making ability.
I think that's very wise, and I appreciate those insights. So I was wondering, too, about the sanctions regime. I don't know what effect they're having. There hasn't been much reporting of that. We know that in the Iraqi lead up to Iraq under the Clinton administration in the 90s, 500,000 children died as a result of sanctions, lack of medicine, lack of food. And the Democrat Secretary of State at the time said, well, that's just the price we pay. And now it looks like we may be doing the same thing to Iran.
Yeah.
We don't know what the effect is.
I'm not familiar with that, but certainly the kind of casual attitude towards civilians is something that is an understated premise in the whole debate about whether to attack Iran, because any attack on Iran, whether it's carried out by Israel or the United States, is going to cause massive civilian casualties. And that's something that's almost never mentioned. It's almost as if Iran's nuclear program, which it has a nuclear program, it's just a question of whether they have an active nuclear weapons program. It's almost as if, we imagine that as just sort of kind of a collection of buildings and instruments, rather than something that's staffed by people, that's located in areas that are certainly nestled within the civilian life of Iran. So, mm-hmm. We just don't think about those things, and it's part because we're not asked to think about them. No one's making us think about it.
Well, it looks like we have our work cut out for us then, because somebody ought to be thinking about it. In my opinion, it
seems like a good thing to do.
Right. We need to ask the questions and hold our leaders feet to the fire and talk about cooler heads prevailing. And I mean, war under any circumstances is outrageously. Well, I guess the best peace sign I've ever seen is the one that says simply, war is not the answer. And I can't think of one time where it was. Certainly wasn't the answer in Iraq. Certainly hasn't been the answer in Afghanistan. I don't know about Libya, but Iran, it just seems that that's sort of going a whole field further from national respectability and sanity. Anyway, Veterans for Peace is going to be working over the summer and try to find ways to convince our leadership, political leadership, that maybe we ought to be looking at other options. Anything you want to conclude with, or...
No, not that I can think. I was just trying to imagine, listening to what I heard about Iraq on the way mm-hmm. to the studio and references to Tony Blair. And I was trying to imagine if the United States went to war or backed an Israeli attack on Iran, who exactly would be the Tony Blair figure. It's not something I've looked at extensively, but it seems like the United States is even more out on a limb with this than it was back in 2002 and 2003, which isn't to say that the United States would do nothing, but it would rank up there in the list of kind of grave historical errors, I would say, in advance. I'd already put it in the list. There's a spot waiting for it, but hopefully it won't be filled.
Well, let us hope that that cool heads prevail and that we can find ways to address international issues with peace and tranquility and diplomacy, and that we lay down our arms and move forward together toward making the world a more perfect place. So I think with that, I'd like to draw it to a close with a recording of a song by Buddy Tabor, who's one of our late great local musicians. He recorded a song called "Peace Was Just a Dream I Had." And so why don't we go out on that, and let me thank everybody once again for showing up and for the help we had this evening.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
It's better to light one candle.